You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The following podcast contains explicit materials. Friday, August 10th, 2018, from Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Yesterday, a tape emerged of discredited nincompoop Devin Nunes telling donors that if Republicans lose the House, don't worry, we'll try to impeach Rod Rosenstein during the lame duck session. He said some other things. There are lots of scrapings of plates in the background. It's kind of annoying. Commenting on this and on Nunes in general was Representative Hakeem Jeffries. He was on MSNBC and he used this phrase.
The so-called chairman of the Intelligence Committee is a complete embarrassment.
Apt, but interesting, because you could take that phrase, so-called chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and take out the so-called and put it before any other clause in the phrase. So one reason why so-called chairman of the Intel Committee works is that he's not really the chairman, or at least not all the time. He got hung out to dry by the ineffectual White House. He went to the White House to get some intel, and the intel was supposed to discredit an investigation into Carter Page. It wound up rebounding onto him. You know, big nightmare. So before Congress itself was going to recommend that Nunes be recused, he said, I'm going to voluntarily step aside. So he's not really the chairman all the time, or even most of the time, for the important things. That is why it is right to call him the so-called chairman. But of course, you could also call him the chairman of the so-called Intelligence Committee. Because under Nunes and Trey Gowdy, this committee has not acted in the pursuit of intelligence, but in the pursuit of obfuscation. It hauled in Peter Strzok, and it did the whole hashtag release the memos thing, which was also a discredited attempt to sully FISA warrants. Again, a huge embarrassment. But then you could take the so-called and put it at the end, where it would read like this. The chairman of the intelligence. Okay, the grammar's a little strained, but here's why it's not even a committee. It's not run as a committee. It's run as an organ for the Republicans on the committee. It's pretty much 100% partisan, and Nunes is constantly trying but failing to outmaneuver Democrat Adam Schiff. Now, in a way, Adam Schiff has the deck stacked against him, but in another way, would that we all had a nemesis as discredited and as much of a nincompoop as Devin Nunes. I also, if you want to be really picky, think the is so-called, because it's not really the Intelligence Committee. It's one of two Intelligence Committees, the other one, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and that does a much better job pursuing issues of intelligence. It does work as a committee, and its Republican chair, Richard Burr, does his job credibly and without nincompoopery, it must be said. Devin Nunes, discredited nincompoop, so-called by me. Often and accurately. On the show today, I spiel about why not. Let's get into another of these characters in the unsavory cacistocracy. It's Omarosa. Yes, she changed her tune a little bit, but once a cacistocrat, always a cacistocrat. But first, he's 50% of the Venture Bros, an adult swim show as crazy and daring as any show out there. You have never seen a show where the creators are less afraid of losing the audience. It's kind of fun. Jackson Public joins us on The Gist of Calamitous Intent.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
So here's how things work around The Gist. I got a couple producers. They're different stripes. of comic book nerds, but I was talking about, I think, Ant-Man and the Wasp. I had just taken my son, and there were some, let us say, flaws or logical inconsistencies. And I had looked up Ant-Man and the Wasp, and this brought me to the Fantastic Four, and someone had issued a compendium of all the things, all the traits that if superheroes had in real life, they'd either die or kill everyone else. And Pierre and Daniel just kept saying, oh yeah, that was in Venture Brothers. Oh yeah, that was in Venture Brothers. And oh yeah, the Human Torch is in Venture Brothers. And I said, what the hell is Venture Brothers? Because I'm a little bit older and not as cool. And then, so this is Ant-Man and the Wasp. This came out a few weeks ago. I did this deep dive into Venture Brothers, and I was blown away by the depth, the universe building, and just the execution of this show that is, it bills itself as a take on Johnny Quest, but it's a lot more than that. Jackson Publick is the man, one of the two creators of the Venture Brothers. He writes just about every episode with his co-creator, and season 7 is up now. Is it the longest running show on the Adult Swim?
I think it is.
Yeah.
But it's like a huge cheat because
yes,
it's 7 seasons in 14 years.
Every other show on TV will say, we're on season 14, and then you're like, wait, you just started 3 years ago. They do like 3 seasons a
year.
I
know, yeah.
You've gone the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So this was originally conceived of or pitched as more a spot-on, I don't know, parody, but take on Johnny Quest. Is that the idea, or is that just how it was kind of like marketed and sold to us?
Yeah, because that's a big seller, right?
Yeah, everyone loves the Johnny Quest.
Hey, remember Johnny Quest? No? Yeah. All right, well, it was this thing, right?
And yeah, well, how about Captain Caveman? Also no? Then that.
You know, that was the template, but it was always our own thing. You know, we were never out to go, okay, what episode of Johnny Quest do we want to parody this week? I mean, although we did do a pretty deep dive for just dumb ideas, you know, like we love just watching crappy things together and riffing on them while we're watching and going, okay, there's a trope we can hit. But it was never intended to be like a perfect analog or a constant spoof of that. It was just a way into a world, because Johnny Quest just stuck in my head for how it looked and for this kind of non-existent genre that it was a part of. It was like, it was part of this great, like, you know, space race era thing where they were like mashing up, obviously, like some James Bond crap and some like Doc Savage stuff. And, you know, it was espionage and adventure with this like atomic sci-fi kind of element to it.
But also the teenage kid, and also a Sikh scientist involved. What's going on?
No, he was just a magic boy that they adopted.
As it happens, yeah.
Yeah, and this sort of cavalier white men, you know, traipsing through other countries and go like, I'll take that boy home.
Right. it was interesting, now that you mention it, it was one of those things like nothing else on TV, but usually we compliment it with that phrase.
Yeah.
This was like, I could see why there's nothing else on TV like this. It really doesn't make that much sense.
But yeah, I mean, it's got, you know, it had had one toe in all these different genres, and that's what was cool to me. You know, I'd done a lot of like superhero type stuff before that, and it was, oh, there's room for superheroes in this world. And, you know.
So how soon did you start getting all the different genres, you know, other than Quest in there? You have your super friends and you have a lot of your Marvel characters. What is the process for inserting those ideas into the series?
It just happens naturally. I mean, I guess right out of the gate, because I mean, even in the pilot, there was a Mr. Fantastic type of guy walking around.
So did you think a lot? Were you, as a person who got his start in comics and loved comics, did you think about did you think more of the logical flaws of the characters, what the characters really would be like in the real world, or more, let's mine these comic characters for comic possibilities? How'd you think about it?
Yeah, I think my MO at the beginning would be like, okay, what kind of torment would this power or this experience be like in real life?
And that's inherently funny.
Yeah. I think that's what I started with when we did The Impossible Family, who were the Fantastic Four. It was like, oh, if you were on fire all the time, it would be incredibly painful.
And
if you were the thing, you were like a big callus, that would be painful too, you know? And the invisible girl, we just made her not quite get invisible, and that was gross, you know?
Yeah. Well, if you
her cross to bear was that she is the wife of this disinterested scientist dude, you know,
So her invisibility made plain, really.
Yeah.
It's really a comment on invisibility. Is there ever a note on your show? I don't know who would give notes. You give a note to Doc or someone gives you a note that you're losing the audience. Because I don't sense that you ever worry that you're losing the audience.
We haven't gotten a note from the network other than please bleep the F word or, you know, hey, you can't show that because we'll get sued.
Uh-huh.
Since the first script of season two or something, they just kind of trust us. Once in a while, you know, I'll have a phone call with Mike Lazo and he'll be like, you're getting a little too deep into your, you know, own asses. And like, you're just, this is, show is impenetrable to, you know, new viewers. And like, we try to think about that or whatever.
But that could be depth about what you've established already, as opposed to pulling a reference.
As far as like, you know, one-off jokes, nobody gives us a hard time. Sometimes Doc and I make fun of each other for our little references, but like, we've learned that if something is funny to us, if something is a personal connection we've made with something, somebody else out there gets it.
Yeah.
And everybody has Wikipedia now anyway. Yeah. So like, either you won't get it and you'll think we came up with this new character who's interesting, or you will get it and go, ah, they wrote that joke just for me. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why we have a really, really devoted fan base, because there's a lot of stuff in it that you go, that there's no way that joke wasn't just for me.
Yeah.
You know,
it's with the kind of show that you laugh at, but you also marvel at. No pun, no comic book pun intended, where you go, oh my God, they noticed that too. They noticed that member of the Legion of Doom had that quirk, as I did. What's the most, can you remember a thing that you and Doc maybe thought would be really obscure that people got like that?
I mean, he made like a Stiv Bader's reference like early on, and you know, the stuff like that.
Just, I don't like, even just, know who Stiv Bader's is.
You know,
a comic book artist?
Look him up. No. That's like punk stuff.
Oh, okay.
Because we'll pull stuff from all over the place, and you know, I think when we first wrote this one episode with like flashbacks to the sort of proto Guild of Calamitous Intent, like 120 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Doc's first draft had really peopled it with very obscure like painters and occultists and stuff that he knew because he was like super into the Gilded Age and stuff like that. I was like,
so it's like from the 1890s.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, you got to throw them a couple of books. Like, please put like, make half of them that, but like, put Mark Twain in there.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on, like,
Jules Verne, maybe.
I don't want you to, you know, pander. I love that we think that's pandering.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, Mark Twain had every right to be there. He was really chummy with Tesla, you know, so it worked.
And what is something that you thought that, okay, this isn't even an obscure reference, that maybe lost people? I don't know if this happened, but maybe you went back and said, ah, I understand why this was confusing. And it wasn't confusing to you two guys, but when it went out into the world, people didn't get exactly what you were trying to do.
I think our season four premiere was ridiculous. I mean, that was just a really strangely constructed episode that, like, the last time I watched it, I'm like, my God, what were we thinking? And it seemed like,
what's wrong with us?
Yeah. It seemed like such a fun, weird idea at the time. And we knew it was strange. It was like, it was all told out of order.
Mm-hmm.
There were kind of two halves to it. One half was moving forward in time chronologically, and the other half, every scene was a flashback moving backwards.
Oh, okay.
So that the first and last scenes of the episode were next to each other.
So did disjointed time, but also Ionesco's goes rhinoceros.
Yeah.
You did both at once. Can that be done?
And then like the only marker you had to tell what time was the value of a comic book, like going down or up, like where we put the I was deep nerd crap, and so it was really confusing. And to make matters worse, at least on the West Coast feed, I think when we premiered, Adult Swim accidentally showed the first act twice. So people out there like came back from commercial and they're seeing the first act again and wondering if we're doing a thing where like, oh, I have to watch it really carefully and see what's different this time. And
there's definitely someone out there with the review. I totally get it. These guys are geniuses.
Yeah. It's the worst episode you could make that mistake with.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
And it, you know, in retrospect, I don't know if we would be that obtuse ever again, but it was, I like that we did it. I like that we have learned on the job and we've made some mistakes and we just try.
And at this rate, season 8 is around 2022, that'll hit. There's usually, sometimes there's a year gap and sometimes there's 2 year gap.
Yeah.
But then sometimes the season lasts 2 years.
I think the, I mean, it, from, if I had all the scripts done for this season already, which for season 8, which we haven't started writing yet,
wow.
It would still take, like, just the animation production itself, if we started tomorrow, takes something like 14, 15 months. So, like, there's no way to do it in a year for us anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's good.
Currently.
has the culture ever gone too fast for you?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not, you know, terribly, you know, present day pop cultural.
No, there are no Trump jokes in there specifically.
No. I mean, we accidentally made one last season.
Like, yeah.
Because when we started season 6, you know, we moved them to New York. And I decided to place their new headquarters on Columbus Circle. Right across the street is one of the Trump towers. So we made made that into Toffett Tower, which is, you know, luxury condos that most of the supervillains live in. And so we had like a party scene, and I wanted, you know, rich New York luminaries in the background. And so we have like a Trump guy as just a background filler character. Then he ran for freaking president like before we were done. And I regretted it, because I'm like, no, the last thing I want to do is make a Trump joke in my show. He doesn't deserve to be in my show. and I did actually, like, we weren't done producing the season. I did take him out of a later crowd scene because I was like, no,
yeah,
I'm not putting his damn face on my show. Screw him. He doesn't deserve it.
Venture Brothers. Another example of the resistance right there at midnight on Adult Swim. Jackson Publick is the co-creator, really 50% of it, along with Doc Hammer. Jackson, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, man.
Absolutely.
Podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And now the spiel. I've been consuming Omarosa's new book. I've just been devouring it. Her descriptions of life in the White House are just delicious. She has got a flair for the spicy detail, which whets my appetite for more dish. Okay, you heard what I was doing there, right? That's a big part of the new tell-all, but probably lies some, by Omarosa Manigault Newman. And this part has captured everyone's attention. So she does say there is tape of the president mentioning the most verboten word in the language. We'll get to that. But she also says that she walked in on the president and witnessed him eating a piece of paper. Yes, it is the first ever accusation of presidential bibliophagy, possibly bibliophagy, depending on how you pronounce it. Sure, FDR vowed, if he were president at the time, he would have eaten Smoot Hawley, but that was just a hypothetical. I know President Trump has been trying to shit all over the Constitution. I didn't know that process began internally. You've heard of the pocket veto? This is the esophageal veto. Mr. President, I told you your third version of the travel ban was a wonderful edict. I didn't say it was wonderful. Eat it. Look, I don't believe any of this happened, or I really don't know what to believe. I'm not even sure I care that much, because Omarosa. There was this series of bold, if true, statements, as reported by the New York Times, describing things in her book, and they built and built into the worst anticlimax since the betting of Stormy Daniels. Here, I'll read this part. Ms. Manigault Newman also claims that Mr. Trump's daughter-in-law tried to buy her silence by offering a $15,000 a month contract. That the president secreted a tanning bed into the White House residence. Oh. That Mr. Trump described his education secretary, Betsy DeVos, as ditzy. Yeah. That he once chewed up a piece of paper to avoid having it collected by presidential record keepers. Weird. And that he routinely comments on women's looks. You don't say. That's a little like parsley as the dessert. By Omarosa's own recognition, she, an African-American woman, knew about Donald Trump using the N-word. In the book, she says she heard about a tape that existed. Today, on an NPR interview, she said she actually heard the tape because, you know, that's how books work. You contradict them during your first big interview trying to promote them. Always a great sign. But in either case, she knowingly signed on to work for the campaign of a man who she knew used the N-word. And she repeatedly went on TV and said things like this in defense of her N-word spewing boss. So I'll play this defense. The issue at the time was Trump was saying that there was a judge who would not treat him fairly because the judge was of Mexican heritage. This is from a Fox interview.
Well, I'm going to take him at his word.
Which word is that, Omarosa? Sorry, I interrupted.
Particularly him saying that these comments were misconstrued. And I also think it's important that I know him personally. And he certainly is not a racist. He doesn't have issues with people of color.
By the time Omarosa was fired, she describes her mindset as a, quote, growing realization that Donald Trump was indeed a racist, a bigot, and a misogynist. I had done the hard work. I had done the deep investigation, the careful vetting. It was hard to pick through the forest of misogyny to see the racism. The smokescreen of prejudice masked the truth of bigotry. The naked and bold pronouncements of anti-Muslim, anti-Latino, anti-Asian, anti-African-American, anti-non-Norwegian country sentiment had blinded me to the fact that he was not as progressive on issues of identity that I had hoped he would be. Now, to be fair to myself, I was distracted along the way by his brilliant and persuasive director of African American outreach. She was beautiful. She was well reasoned. Let us remember this thing that she once said.
Well, I'm going to take him at his word.
So, yes, I admit all that got in the way of this nagging feeling I had in the back of my head that the man who said immigrants from Haiti, quote, all have AIDS, might not be speaking just out of a knowledge of communicable diseases. And perhaps he might have better addressed the 1,400 people in Puerto Rico who were killed by Hurricane Maria, might have addressed them better than just by tossing paper towels into a crowd and calling them, quote, politically motivated ingrates. My suspicion was growing. And then there was one more thing. Pardoning Joe Arpaio. And also disavowing knowing David Duke. And continually calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. And then there was this time when he said this.
Look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest?
Him? When I realized I wasn't Donald's African-American, well, that's when the questions in my mind really grew into a slightly strong suspicion. And I vowed right then that I would only serve another 5 months on the campaign, get a job on staff, and work for a year or so. This is me, Mike, now. I'm transitioning out of the Omarosa mindset, and I will just advise you this. America, please buy Omarosa's book. She seems like a clear voice, a reliable narrator, and a person who badly, if not desperately, needs the attention. If this ends in anything other than her getting her own reality show, I'll eat my words, and you know I'm not joking. And that's it for today's show. Daniel Schrader produces The Gist. Like comic strip stalwart Kathy consumed chocolate, Daniel consumes raw wisdom, making him a sageophage. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, eats up all the offerings of one of America's bright young hip-hop artists. He's a major laser phager. The Gist can't get enough of the last track of Arcade Fire's 2007 LP, Neon Bible. I'm a real... My body is a cage of phage, and Peter Gabriel is late to this feast. Oompuru depuru dupuru, and thanks for listening.